good to be here, and especially since I also was able to see the great facilities, for instance, in Dachstuhl in Germany. So I take this as another step as to have less reasons for me to return to Germany, I guess. My name is Torsten Müller. I'm from School of Computing Science at Simon Fraser University, and I'd like to give you a little flavor of the type of field that I'm working in, which is volume graphics, and some of the challenges in that field and how volume graphics challenges us. So in the outline of my talk, I'll be talking a little bit what is volume graphics or what is volume graphics dealing with, and then basically look at what the challenges are that I personally see as addressing the accuracy of the process, addressing the speed of the process in connection with that, also the size of the problem, and last but not least, the interaction with our data and finding intuitive ways to interact and explore the data at hand. And I'll conclude with some summary. So volume graphics, the field of volume graphics, is really dealing with just a set of points. A set of points are distributed in space and basically describe an underlying problem, an underlying object that we're trying to study. And there are two major, or people consider there are two major areas where we get these data from, and one of them is medical, where we basically have computer tomography, magnetic resonance imaging, SPECT imaging, PET imaging, ultrasound, as well as seismic data sets, where the principle is really that a certain object is sliced electronically. And where basically these slices are made up of a whole bunch of points. They're stacked up together to basically create a three-dimensional description of the underlying body of the underlying object. And here's some examples, some MRI scan, some ultrasound scan there in the middle, also microscopy data sets people are looking at, or terrain data sets. Another important area of where volume graphics has great use are numerical simulations, where people basically study physical problems, chemical problems, all sorts of other problems, describe them through a mathematical framework, create very difficult partial differential equations that are typically only can be solved at a very particular point. And so people solve them on a lot of different points, and the collection of these data points basically describe the underlying data set, again, through a cloud of samples. These are a bunch of examples again here. We're typically, those are standard data sets that we're studying, a delta wing data set as well as a blunt fin data set. And there's all sorts of other applications out there people are looking at. So classical graphics really comes from surfaces as opposed to what people would call volumes. And the question is, can we incorporate them? Should we incorporate them? And the answer, yes, we want to incorporate them. And there's a lot of research actually in the past few years in trying to merge the two fields and enhance volume graphics by using geometrical models, geometrically defined objects, at the same token to enhance surface graphics to really efficiently display really high accuracy surface-based models. Again, a little example here. Those are basically primitives that were created using traditional geometric modeling techniques, then discretized and included in the volume rendering or volume graphics pipeline, and then basically volume graphics was used to render them, to project them onto the screen. So what we're dealing with in volume graphics is really trying to comprehend this three-dimensional point data set and project it onto the screen, basically collapse that high-dimensional representation to 2D images that we can look at on a computer. And there's all sorts of applications. Here's just a small overview of some of them. Of course, medical imaging is a big application that we're dealing with. A lot of computational fluid dynamics, computational field simulations, a lot of computational applications play a role here. All sorts of other things. Also, a bunch of educational tools are being created, for instance, to guide surgeons or students that want to become surgeons to train in surgical procedures and all sorts of other stuff. And there's lots more. So, but how's this process, or how, what algorithms, or how's the algorithm performed to project or to take this cloud of points onto the screen, to project that onto the screen? And there's various different steps, and the main conceptual steps I want to point out here. And the first one is probably trying to create a mapping of the underlying data to visual properties, because that's what we end up seeing on the computer screen. So typically in medical data sets, we record some sort of proton density. Proton density we can't see. We have to transform that into some sort of color, but also opacity. Same with computational data sets where we're recording temperature or pressure. We can't see them. We have to attach visual properties to them. So opacity mapping here, actually, that means we either see a sample or we don't see a sample, allows us to selectively find specific features in a data set. So all that stuff is done usually in the classification step. Then, since we're projecting a three-dimensional, sometimes higher-dimensional data set onto a 2D display, we are losing dimension information. Okay, and there's various different ways of getting this back, and one very effective way is actually using light sources and trying to light the three-dimensional object at hand. So we're computing some sort of light interaction with our underlying object. And finally, we need to collect all this information of the colors we assign to of the three-dimensional object and collapse it onto a 2D image, which is done in a compositing step. And then hopefully we might be happy with the image that we're getting. So one of the challenges of volume graphics, also in particular, is of course the accuracy. Okay, how reliable is the data that we're actually seeing on the screen? Is it really what we have recorded through very difficult differential equations, or what the MRI scanner gave us back? So the question is what you see really what you have? And that's often very difficult to answer, actually. There are typically two problems that can occur. The first problem is that we're producing artificial things in the 2D image that are actually not in the data set. And the other problem is that we're not able to display things that are actually in the data set, and we're missing those details. So accuracy is really important for the analysis of the underlying object. And one basic or very simple example is simply if we're using these softwares to aid a doctor in making a diagnosis, then we want to be pretty sure that what the doctor sees through that display is really what's there. So what is really needed here and what people are working on is a good mathematical framework to represent this whole algorithm. And we're drawing basically from ideas from signal processing and, of course, numerical analysis and analysis in general. And more and more also what plays an important role is perception research, where people take the human visual model, human visual system, into account in creating those images. So a lot of our work has been actually in that field, especially in looking at how the light interacts with the underlying model and what kind of possible errors we can accumulate in the compositing step that collapses the 3D to the 2D image. And there we're using a lot of ideas also from signal processing in combination with numerical mathematics, and basically design new reconstruction methods, which are also called filter design, in order to improve the visualization of the data sets. And so here you see just an example of actually a synthetic function, which is used quite a bit to compare different algorithms. It's also referred to as the marginal op data set. And what you really see here is some sort of error image. That means where the image is very light, it's a lot of error. Where the image is dark, we only introduce little error. So we can see that we can change not only we can not only make more accurate images as such, but we also can introduce or get rid of certain artifacts. Like in the first row of images, you have a lot of what's called sort of aliasing artifacts and discontinuities, which are also typically a visual problem, which are getting rid of in the second row of images. So, but of course, all the questions of accuracy are by far not answered, and some of the real difficult problems are actually unreliable data. If the acquisition process where we're getting the data from produces data that basically includes noise or includes unreliabilities, how do we deal with this? And one very prominent example of this is probably ultrasound, where we have a lot of what's called speckles and noise in the image. And I actually pulled this image from a work by Ronan Fatah that has just introduced a very nice algorithm to deal with these, especially for ultrasound, and basically reconstruct the fetus that perhaps you can see here. But also to give you an idea of really how difficult ultrasound data is, also what you see on the right-hand side there is a very simple sphere, that's all. It's actually a golf ball. Another big problem that we're dealing with is typically what we call irregular data sets. And those are data sets that are based on very complicated sampling. Okay, a lot of the work that has been done previously and where fast and very good algorithms were developed are really based on very nicely spaced grids. Means all the samples that we acquire have the same distance with each other, to each other. Versus there's a lot of research, especially in numerical mathematics, scientific computing, where adaptive algorithms are proposed to deal with very complicated computational algorithms. And they're, of course, acquiring data samples all over the place, just not on these nice regular grids. So there's a lot of problems in how do we reconstruct in between and how do we devise fast algorithms to deal with that. And I alluded to it also earlier, one of the other big problems is our human visual system. Okay, our human visual system, unfortunately, doesn't really correspond very nicely to our nice mathematical errors that we're typically producing. So a little example here is, by the way, this image was taken from Raghu Machu Raju. This is not Raghu Machu Raju. So this is the original image. And this is the same image, simply added a constant bias to the whole image. And for us, it looks fairly nice, almost no difference. And if we're taking just a usual numerical error metric here, that means we're taking corresponding pixels, subtract them with each other, and add up the error that we're getting, we actually get a huge error. Versus the image on the right-hand side is the same original image as before, and just a few pixels are actually disturbed. A few sample points are disturbed. And those sample points are particularly chosen on what appears to be edges in the image. Okay, and for us, that image looks a lot worse than the image in the middle. But if we're computing our numerical error metric here, it shows that the error over there is a lot smaller than the error over here. So there's a problem in correspondence in what we actually visually perceive. And so a lot of research needs to be done there. There's some very nice work already in that field. But what we basically need is perceptual error metrics. And they need to be incorporated into our algorithms. The other challenge is... Another challenge is actually that we're facing is speed, and why speed in particular has to do with the high dimensionality of our algorithms also. Because we typically look at three-dimensional objects, or sometimes also time-varying or four-dimensional or higher-dimensional objects, we're producing 2D images of it, we're losing a lot of dimensionality. And I mentioned earlier, one way to get this higher dimensionality back is through lightning, or light in the scene. Another very important way to do this, if we're able to quickly change the image and are able to interactively rotate the image, which typically means we want to produce 30 images per second or 60 images per second. It's a great way of getting another dimension back, is this interaction with the actual image. So very fast algorithms are of great importance. And they're typically achieved through very efficient algorithms and efficient data structures. What we're typically seeing here also is we can gain speed by neglecting accuracy. And the question is, what is a good trade-off here? A lot of these algorithms and data structures are based on compressed data, and here we also need to do more research on adapting specific algorithms to very compressed ways of the data, or compressed versions of the data. Another big direction is to create special hardware to speed up these algorithms, or to use common graphics hardware that's out there that you can buy for really cheap for your PC to enhance these algorithms. And there's lots of advancements in those fields as well. So our approach to compressed data is really in terms of really trying to look at how do we encode information in the data set. And so with typical medical imaging or a lot of other imaging as well, the points are recorded on Cartesian grids. And in fact, it turns out that they're not really the most efficient way to store this data. So in fact, we're proposing to use hexagonal grids, and we're adapting a lot of algorithms on this type of grid structure, because you can actually represent the same information with 30% less samples, 30% less data points, which is a great savings. And you see here the number 40%, and in our implementations of the algorithms, we actually get a 40% savings, because now with 30% less data, the whole algorithm can be streamlined a lot better, and some of the other bottlenecks in the rendering pipeline also improve. So that's why we get actually a 40% improvement. And so you see the same data set here. One is sampled on a Cartesian grid, and one is sampled on a hexagonal grid. We've also done a bunch of work on improving the data structure that data is stored on, and we have proposed what's called an adjacency data structure, which efficiently skips voxels or data points that are actually not be seen, or that the user said, I don't want to see them. Using that, we can process up to 1 million data points per second in a high-quality rendering architecture. And that's more than twice as fast than previous algorithms. And we find the ideas, and we played around with a typical run length encoding of the data set as well. And have reached up to 6 or 7 times the speed of previous data sets. So we can process up to 2.7 million data points or sample points per second. So a lot of these problems actually come together in what's called terascale visualization, which is a big keyword in our field at the moment. And those are very, very large data sets in the order of terabytes, gigabytes, etc. They're typically becoming so large because the data is time-varying. We're not dealing with just one snapshot of a physical process, but a whole time series, often hundreds of time steps. And another complicated issue is the multidimensionality of the underlying data sets. So per sample point, we don't record just like proton density, or not only temperature, but we're also recording pressure and velocity vectors, et cetera, et cetera. So per data sample, we actually have a lot more information. The question is, how do we incorporate that into the visualization aspect? Also, most of the time, these data sets, because they're from engineering problems, are based on irregular type grids. And they're often produced on supercomputers, highly parallel architectures. and most of the time they're we're trying to visualize them on more commonly used workstations. Another huge problem that really is also a problem with more smaller data sets, but especially here, is the question is, how do we interact with this data set? How do we find regions that we're really interested in? How do we efficiently extract and intuitively extract certain features that this data set have and that we might be interested in? Because most of the time when we're trying to explore our underlying data, we're not always 100% sure what we're looking for or what the data set has to offer. So there's a lot of research in the way of creating intuitive ways to interact with the data set. One very nice example was actually here, work by that was done at Mitsubishi Electronic Research Lab, where they're devising a genetic algorithm to basically exhaustively search the whole space of possible visualization mappings and then create an interface to efficiently navigate through that space. To give you a little better idea of what I'm talking about, here's the data set that physicists actually use to extract certain information or particular information. All these visualizations were done on the exact same data, no change in the data. The only change that happened is the classification function, the function where we map each data sample into a particular color and in this case in a particular opacity. So the same data set reveals here bone structure and over there muscle structure and other soft tissue, but all this stuff can also be visualized in combination. Okay, and this was done without any fancy interfaces. Was done a few years ago, and I think it took her like 2 or 3 days to come up with the appropriate values. Another active area of research is really how can we get immersed into the data set? How can we get a different feeling for the data set other than our two-dimensional computer screen? And so there's a lot of work in trying to define interesting hardware interfaces to let us explore our data sets. And so there's a lot of work in what's called augmented reality. Like I said, they're exploring new and different input-output devices to interact with those data sets. And what I portray here is what is probably fairly well known as the cave environment. So in summary, the challenges that are facing us are accuracy, first of all. We need to define a mathematical framework that lets us estimate what kind of accuracy our algorithms really have. We need to make sure that what we see is really what's there in the data set. Okay. We need to be able to deal with noise as well as irregular data representations, and we need to incorporate the human visual system into our visualization algorithms. We need to deal with speed, basically, in order to get the lost dimension back. Okay, we need to devise fast algorithms, where the focus here is, at the moment, at parallel implementations as well as multi-resolution approaches. And we're working on better data representations and the utilization and the creation of new hardware, the utilization of current hardware, as well as devising new ideas for special hardware, for volume graphics. Our data acquisition methods become better and better. So with other words, our data sets become larger and larger and larger. So how do we deal with that? This is an important research direction. And here especially is also, how do we deal with time-varying data sets? And all this stuff can be summarized as terascale visualization. And last but not least is, how do we find intuitive ways to interact with our underlying data? How do we find intuitive ways to explore our data from a software development as well as from a hardware development point of view? important questions to answer and an active research topic. Finally, I'd like to thank a whole bunch of people that I collaborated with over the years, especially also current students at Simon Fraser University, Steve Kilthow and Jeff Orchard, as well as Tom Teusel from Vienna University of Technology, and some of my mentors at Ohio State University, Professor Raghu Majiraju, Professor Roger Crofis, and Ronnie Egal, and some people that I worked with over the years, Professor Klaus Müller at SUNY Stony Brook, and Dr. Yair Kurtzion at SGI, as well as Dr. Ed Swan at the Naval Research Lab. And some of this work was made possible through funding by NSERC, as well as the British Columbia Advanced System Institute. Thank you. So if you have more questions, please get in touch with me. One final comment is, in Dachstuhl, one of the most happening conversations and discussions usually were done in the evening in the well-equipped rooms with a lot of really good German beverages, so that might be a hint here. Thank you very much for your attention.